Is this mic like giving me a ton of problems? Okay. See how it goes. So this could have been a really short sermon this week because on Wednesday, I went to turn on my computer, which is what I do all my sermon work on, and I couldn't get it to turn on. So I panicked a bit, but Sue was fortunately going down to Utica and brought it with her to New Hartford and brought it to Best Buy. And they were able to get it working again. And so it's still limping along. And I backed up all my files. So even if it does give up the ghost, I still have copies of the sermons that I'm working on for following weeks. But anyway, it could have been really short. So maybe you're disappointed by that or maybe you're encouraged by that. I don't know. But it's not going to be short. So I probably shouldn't have told you that to get your hopes up. Jerusalem for the Jew is not an ordinary city. It is special, special to the Jew because it is special to God. This is the place that God had chosen, place he had selected, chosen it as his dwelling place. So it says in Psalm 132, for the Lord has chosen Zion. Zion's another name for Jerusalem. He has desired it for his dwelling, saying, this is my resting place forever and ever. Here I will sit enthroned, for I have desired it. He's chosen it, desired it, his dwelling place, his resting place, where he sits enthroned. This is profound. Of all the places on earth that God could have chosen, he's chosen this place to dwell, Jerusalem. Clearly, this is a special city, but it's not particularly picturesque. Not really abounding in natural resources. It's this rocky plateau perched between two valleys. It is a vulnerable piece of real estate. As the capital of a region that stands between Egypt in the south, long established as a perpetual world power, and most of the natural travel routes between that Egypt in the south and all of the other world powers of the day, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Persians, the Babylonians, whoever, the way to get from Egypt to those world powers is straight through Israel. And so oftentimes, Israel became a contested battleground, and Jerusalem as its capital became object of siege and attack by many. Despite all this, God has chosen this place as special and calls it, according to 1 Kings 11:36, the place that he has chosen to put his name. He's etched his identity into this place, tied himself to a location. The Jews know this. So during the reign of Solomon, who's David's son, a temple as a permanent structure for God's presence has been erected. It's a way to house God's glory. The Holy of Holies in the center of the temple shelters his throne between the cherubim of the cover of the Ark of the Covenant. God dwelt in a physical manifestation of his presence, hidden behind the veil. But now, in the course of history, Jerusalem has been defeated. Temples in ruins. Of course, this didn't happen overnight. The writing had been on the wall for some time. 10 years earlier, Nebuchadnezzar, ruler of the Babylonians, had already muscled Jerusalem into submission and installed a puppet king who was expected to pay tribute to the Babylonians and to know his place in cowering submission to the Babylonian ruler. But this king, Zedekiah, had gotten some ideas of independence into his head and declared his allegiance to Egypt. Living by the aphorism that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, he decided to capitalize on the opposition between the Egyptians and the Babylonians fighting over world dominance. Of course, this news was poorly received by Nebuchadnezzar, who reacted by laying siege to the city, a tightening grip that lasted for a year and a half as he sought to break through the city walls. All the while, the Babylonians were surrounding the city, letting no one in or out, and with no access to their fields for farming crops or to pasture for grazing flocks. The food supplies were depleted and the people were beginning to starve. The wall was finally breached and the city was conquered. The king, Zedekiah, was captured and his sons were killed before his eyes, before gouging those eyes out as he was led away in shackles. Most of the population was led away too, but the poorest people were left behind to work the fields and the vineyards, living amidst the rubble. The temple was ransacked. Everything bronze or silver or gold was carted off: pots, wick trimmers, bowls, shovels, pillars. And then Nebuzaradan, who was the commander of the Babylonian army, burned the temple, burned it to the ground. This is God's dwelling place, the place that he's chosen, desired, placed his name, and these Babylonians have destroyed it, like vandals breaking into your home and stealing everything of value to you and then burning your house to the ground. This is what they have done to God's house. It's more than just conquest. This is malicious. This is destructive. This is a crushing defeat. And it's not just the Israelites. It is also their God, Yahweh, who is intentionally being kicked around by the Babylonians. His house pillaged and burned. He has been violated. His home has been reduced to a charred pile of rubble. And it's this tragedy the psalmist is reacting to. In Psalm 74, the psalmist pictures this destruction in his own poetic way. The Babylonians roaring like a lion in the temple, their fierce snarl enough to send shivers down your spine. This is no mousy reverence. This is a roaring defiance for the Babylonians. They have come in and swung their axes wildly, slashing at the lavish woodwork the way that woodcutters attack a thicket of trees. These finely carved, artistic wooden panels in the temple have been brutishly hacked to a splintering pile. Not emphatic enough, they have capped off their onslaught with fire. They have burned the temple remains. In fact, this fire rampage extends not just to the temple, but to every place where they've worshiped God. It's all burnt. It's violent. It's aggressive. And it's targeted. They are committed to absolute destruction, crushing them completely. The temple and the worship of Yahweh, God, are not just unintended casualties in this overthrow. There is a deliberate antagonism toward the God of the Jews. They are intentionally defiling the dwelling place of God's name. The physical damage to the building cannot begin to convey the deeper damage to God's reputation. That's the story. The Israelites defeated. The God of the Israelites insulted and defiled. And yet, there's no indication that God intends to intervene. Verse 9 struggles with that silence. There is no signs, no prophecies, no indication of how long this will last. God could change this situation, but he's given no hint that he intends to do so. He's silent. No explanation. How can this be right? How can this be good? How can this be permissible? How can this be just? And that's the intersect for us. Because this is not just a lesson about history. The Psalms are a corporate songbook instructing us in our own worship, in our own relationship with God. And we're not dealing with temples and Babylonian invaders, but we are dealing with situations where God may seem silent and unaware and indifferent, situations where we wonder how that can be right or good or permissible or just, and situations where God has given no hint of his intention to intervene. And this is what raises the questions in the Psalms. surrounding this depiction of all this devastation that is brought by the Babylonians as they have defiled and insulted God, the psalmist is left scratching his head and wondering aloud how God could allow this. Not just hypothetically, but with this urgency, with this angst, pain, and sorrow. He's emotionally wrapped up in this. We hear him wrestling with this in four questions that are posed, four that he floats out there, two before and two after this description of destruction that he's given us. He's trying to figure it out. Why God would allow this? First two questions are a bit selfish, but understandable. The first question: well, God, why have you rejected us forever? Standing amidst the rubble, the psalmist is distressed by more than just the ruins that are there. The point is something that hurts deeper than that. God appears indifferent and inactive. That's not evidence of the awesome power of the Babylonians. It's an indication that God has rejected them. They could rebuild the temple, but if God's abandoned them, what hope is there? Second question: why does your anger smolder against the sheep of your pasture? That is evocative language. To use the word smolder in reference not to the pile of rubble that was there, that used to be their magnificent temple, but of God's anger is startling. The Babylonians burned the temple, but it is God's anger that continues to smolder on and on. You'd think God would be angry with the Babylonians. But it appears that his anger is directed toward his own people, the sheep in his pasture, those that he's expected to take care of. So those are the first two questions: self-conscious, confused by God's rejection. Why, God? Why? And these are the kinds of questions that people struggle with today. When they face situations that are unjust and unfair, some version of that question: why, God? Why me? Why this? What did I do to deserve this? Are you indifferent, God? Are you angry? Those are the questions that the psalmist is dealing with. After recounting the devastation that the has come through the Babylonians, the psalmist returns to questions again in verse 10 and 11. But now the questions are a bit different. Not concerned with self-interest. Now the psalmist is thinking of God's honor. Not why us, but why you, Lord? So, third question: how long will the enemy mock you, God? Will the foe revile your name forever? It's not just for the sake of the Israelites. It's God's reputation here at stake. He is being mocked. His name is being reviled. Will God just let this go on indefinitely with no intervention? Because when the whys stem from self-interest, why me? The frightening explanation is that God doesn't care, or even worse, that God is angry at me. I'm being ignored, or I'm being actively punished. And those are frightening prospects. But when the whys stem from concern over God's reputation, it raises another frightening prospect. Maybe it's not that God doesn't care or that he's angry. What if it is that God is inept, powerless, at the mercy of these foes? What if God is just this man-made crutch that is not real, does not exist? Or is some impersonal life force, more an it than a he? A vague, new agey spirituality that does not involve a personal God. Because if he is personal, and if he is powerful, why would he allow his name to be trampled this way? So the fourth question: why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Take it from the folds of your garment and destroy them. The hope is that this is not a reflection of God's ineptness, that God must be able to squash this rebellion if he would just raise his hand. This would be all that it would take for him to destroy his opposition if he wished. All he needs to do, all of the troops, all of the artillery, all of the siege works, all of the plundering, all of the insulting, all of the roaring, finished. If he would just take his hand out of the fold of his garments. Or to put that into our wardrobes, if he would just take his hands out of his pockets and use them, he has the power. If God is so strong, why does he appear so weak in regard to his people, his temple, his honor? Will he allow himself to be thought of as inferior to the Babylonian gods? We just let his temple be left in shambles. Now, those are hard questions. Hard questions to wrestle with, but they are questions that we wrestle with. Is God real? Does he care? Why is he allowing things to happen in my circumstances that don't seem right or fair or just? And then the tone shifts. Focus is taken off of the immediate situation of the temple ruins and a people that feel abandoned, a God insulted, and instead and turned to God's power and might. Verse 12, this is the heartbeat of this psalm. This is what pumps blood through every verse in this poem. Verse 12 is this confident declaration. But God is my king from long ago. He brings salvation on the earth. It's the heartbeat of this verse. And the heartbeat of our God. My king brings salvation. In this situation, the deliverance hasn't come yet. Here, in this moment. But God has this extensive track record of bringing deliverance. He hasn't here yet, but he has so often before that I can have confidence that he will do it again. God brings salvation. This is just what he does. It is his nature. And then God is addressed directly 8 times with this emphatic you. There are no imperatives, no demands, no requests, just affirmations, assertions of fact. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of the Leviathan and gave it as food to the creatures of the desert. It was you who opened up springs and streams. You dried up the ever-flowing rivers. The day is yours, yours also the night. You established the sun and moon. It was you who set the boundaries of the earth. You made both summer and winter. That lament is lifted. The despair is combated. The uncertainty is settled. The focus is placed on God's actions. If you just are looking at the current state of affairs, you may wonder how God is anything but impotent. But God's power here is not in dispute. The psalmist knows that this is a powerful God who has brought salvation on the earth over and over again. That's what he does, time and again. Most commentators agree that verses 13 to 15 are this poetic description of the Exodus and their entry into the promised land. God splitting the sea is the crossing of the Red Sea and the people being led out of Egypt. And then this talk about sea monsters and crushing the Leviathan, that's poet speak for the Egyptians, them being drowned in the Red Sea and the power of Pharaoh being defeated by God. And then opening up springs of water is this reminder of how God repeatedly, through their years of wandering through the wilderness, provided for their needs for water by giving them water from a rock or directing them to a spring. And then drying up the river is this reflection of the river of Jordan being split open and them passing into the promised land on the other end under the leadership of Joshua. God bringing salvation on the earth. And all this poetic language elevates this historical moment of God bringing them out of captivity and into freedom is just brought into a grander theme with the language that he uses. God is victor over the cosmos. So he crushes the heads of sea monsters and feeds them like hors d'oeuvres to desert creatures. This sets up this section where it highlights his control in nature. The day and the night are his. They belong to him. He is in control of all of these things. That he has the sun and the moon in his control. He puts them in their place. He establishes them to govern the day and the night. He sets the boundaries of the earth between sea and land. He has made summer and winter. He is in control of the natural world. And with night and winter as pairings with day and summer, there may be this implicit poetic reflection the hardship that they're now facing. Night and winter is the time of hardship and difficulty and confusion, when it seems like God's forgotten and is silent. But God is the God of the night. And God is the God of winter. Affliction may come just like night comes, but night is followed by day. And winter comes, summer now, but in a couple months, camps are going to be closing up and water lines are drained and propane tanks being filled and locals hunkering down. Winter will come, but every winter is followed by summer. Every night followed by day. The sun rises each morning. So certainly, my God brings salvation on the earth. As sure as the Exodus follows the captivity, as sure as summer follows winter, as sure as day follows night, God brings salvation. But that bringing of salvation implies some sort of backdrop of captivity, of bondage, of difficulty, of unrest. To bring salvation demands a situation that invites saving. There is no Exodus without a captivity. God is not bashing the heads of sea monsters if you're just talking about an aquarium with goldfish. There must be sea monsters for him to bash the heads of. So if this is the heartbeat of the psalm, and if this is the heartbeat of our God, that is why God brings salvation on the earth. That this glorious truth demands that there is a setting where God's salvation is needed in our experience. And sometimes we need a reminder that we need that saving, that we are in desperate need of him, that we need a situation that elicits this kind of psalm that asks God, where are you? Why are you allowing this to happen? Because that then opens our eyes to see him. The deeper the darkness, the brighter the light is when it shines through. And this horrid destruction by the Babylonians is setting up this glorious intervention when God will restore the fortunes of Israel and defend the honor of his name. And for you, whatever that night is, whatever that winter is that you face, that is setting up an opportunity for God to prove himself as the God who brings salvation on the earth. So this is where the psalm ends. Repeated requests for God not to forget, that God intervene, that God defend his name and his vulnerable people. Remember how people have defiled your name. Don't forget us. Have regard for your covenant. Rise up and defend your cause. God, we know that you are not indifferent to us and that you are not impotent. You are God who brings salvation on the earth. So do that here in this moment. Do that now for the sake of your afflicted people. Don't let the oppressed retreat in disgrace. For the sake of your cause, in defense of your name and your honor. That's a bold prayer. But these are prayers that God delights to hear. Confidence in him, entreating his intervention, concern for the afflicted, defending the honor of his name. God bringing salvation. That is the heartbeat of this psalm and the heartbeat of our God. And when he sends his son into the world, his son is given the name Jesus because, according to the gospel and according to the angel who instructs him to be given that name, he will save his people from their sins. His name, Jesus, means the Lord saves. This is the heartbeat of our God. Our God brings salvation on the earth. That is his name. God saves. And the reality is that that point where we see the arrival of his son and his being named the Lord saves brings all of this into perspective, because whatever we may face, no matter how dark that night and no matter how cold that winter is, the perspective is changed when viewed in light of his sending of salvation through Christ, through Jesus. through the one named the Lord saves, because that is the heartbeat of that psalm and that is the heartbeat of our God. God will bring salvation on the earth. And that salvation comes through Christ, who comes and offers his life as a sacrifice for our sin, as a solution for all corruption in the world, to find its redemption in him. Our God brings salvation on the earth. And that salvation comes through the gift of his Son. So, whatever night you're dealing with and whatever winter it is that you're facing, the reality is that even in the midst of that, you say, why, God? You question what his purposes are. You wonder why he hasn't changed it. The reality is that he is using those things to draw you, to draw you to where salvation is found in no one else but through Christ our Lord. Let's pray. So, Lord, this is one of those psalms that is just hard. Hard questions being asked, Lord, and being pushed upon you, Lord, questioning your love and your concern and your power and whether you are able. But we see it in the psalm, the perspective changing, the attitude being brought back to a realization of confidence in you, Lord, that you are God who brings salvation on earth. And so, Lord, whatever it is that we're facing, I pray that that would be our perspective. As hard as it may be, Lord, that we would see that you are a God who brings salvation in that, and that we would have hope in you. Lord, ultimately, my prayer is that each one of us would find that that finds its expression most clearly in the gift of your Son, the offer of salvation from our sin. So, Lord, I pray that each person here